Okay, members, we don't have a quorum yet, but I want to be respectful of people that came here already. So we're going to unofficially start. And I think before we do that, we do have some new staff to welcome to the committee. We have Nick, and I believe it's Kevin.
Yes.
I forgot to have you guys introduce yourselves yesterday. They are going to be our permanent pages for the committee. And if you guys could maybe step to the microphone. It looks like you're a little swamped. Kelly's got you at a fast clip this morning, it looks like.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Nick. I'll be your page throughout the entire thing. Just graduated from Gustavus, so, yeah.
Great. Nick, what's your last name?
Nigro.
Nigro. Okay. Nick Nigro.
My name is Kevin Petrie, and I'm very excited to be here.
Great. Excellent. Well, welcome, guys. Hope you enjoy state government finance. Let's see. We're getting close to quorum. I think we're almost there. Today, members, we've got, we're going to start reviewing the governor's budget, and we've got some agency folks here to come and give some presentations on their change items that they're looking at. But you'll also notice what we've done is we've put together committee books for you. Because we have so many agencies, I think it's helpful for you as members to be able to look at all of the documents. These books will stay with the committee. If you want to take them into your office, it's under your own responsibility to return them. You get one book and one book only. If you want one after that and you lose it somewhere, you're on your own. So Kelly has spent a lot of time putting these together and appreciate her work. She was here last night. I left at 9. She was still here. So give her a little break today, too, because she's probably a little tired. We also have some spreadsheets that I think will be helpful for you. Helen Roberts, our fiscal analyst, has put together some data for us, and that's in this packet. It's about 20 pages long. We're going to try and get you a colored version of this in the legal size paper, because I don't know about you, but my eyesight isn't this good. This is very tiny. So we're going to try and get a bigger copy for you for the next go around, but due to time constraints, this is what we could do for this moment. So that'll give you kind of the big picture. And I think with that, we're going to officially start State Government Finance Committee meeting. And I would like, if Representative Pugh, can you move the minutes for us?
So move, Madam Chair.
So we have the minutes from February 3rd for State Government Finance. All those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? The minutes for February 3rd, 2015 are approved. What we'll do just to start off with is Ms. Roberts will go through, we're going to start with MMB, so she will just go highlight their numbers from the spreadsheet. And then what we'll do is we'll have MMB come forward and talk numbers. So to start with, you're going to want to start with this 20-page packet and then look up on the MMB numbers. And with that, Ms. Roberts.
And Madam Chair and members, I should point out there's actually two spreadsheets, hopefully, in your packet. There's the 20-page detailed tracking, which will show you the base funding plus any changes and then the recommended new funding level. But there's also a one-page change item spreadsheet, which will let you focus on just the change items that are being recommended. So it might be easier to look at that one at this point. For Minnesota Management and Budget, they have three recommended change items from the governor's budget. The first is an operating adjustment of 1.8% on their compensation base, and that's a total of $866,000. And this is on line 50 of the change item spreadsheet. The second item is a total of $6 million for the biennium to maintain enterprise systems. That's related to all of the systems that MMB operates for the state, including the accounting system, budget system, et cetera. And then the last item is $2 million for the biennium to enhance enterprise-level services. So the total for the biennium is $8.866 million in recommended funding.
Okay. Is everyone tracking on where we're at? Okay. All right. Thank you, Ms. Roberts. Mm-hmm. And then also, you can look at kind of the historical data on the large tracking sheet, too, if that's helpful for you as well. Okay. With that, we are going to start off with Commissioner Franz. And looks like you brought a tag team with you, too. So if you can introduce yourself for the record. And then just for members' sake, too, so when you look at your committee book, all you got to do is look at MMB. It's all alphabetical. And that will help you be able to look at each change item proposed by the division. So, Commissioner Franz, welcome once again.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. Thank you for the opportunity to come in this morning. My name is Myron Franz, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget.
And good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Michelle Weber. I'm the Enterprise Resource and Planning Director at Minnesota Management and Budget.
Welcome. Are you going to kick us off, Commissioner?
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd like to. So this is the document that I'm going to start reviewing, the one that has the Minnesota Management and Budget at the top right. And you see a bunch of boxes there. So if we'll start there, I'd like to, thank you, Madam Chair, I'd like to briefly talk a little bit about the agency and then get right into the change items that you're reviewing at this point. I understand you have a lot of business this morning, and we do what we can to keep it moving along. But I think the structure and the purpose of Minnesota Management and Budget is critical to state government. One of the things that the Minnesota Management and Budget tries to do is to try to provide the right kind of services so that we can manage our financial aspects of running this enterprise, the workforce development, training, recruitment, information resources necessary to run an enterprise like the state of Minnesota, and obviously try to make those services as efficient and as effective as possible. Now, we try to do this at MMB through financial responsibility techniques, future workforce preparation with training and benefits, and also effective and efficient network systems. So you can see by the little chart that shows by the numbers that we have 260 full-time employees at MMB. We serve over 100 state government entities. We negotiate 10 different labor agreements. We manage a $5.7 billion debt portfolio. We provide 54,000 vendor payments a week. We process 110,000 paychecks per month. And we insure about 120,000 state employees. And we also, as you know, provide two budget economic forecasts, one which just happened in November, and the next one coming up on February 27th. The bottom part of that front page shows the breakdown of the $1.8 billion allocation to the MMB. As you can see at the bottom, by far the largest appropriation here goes toward the state employee group insurance program and the public employee insurance program, about 95% or $911 million of the $1.8 billion is provided through that insurance mechanism. So what we tried to do, the rest of that chart was show you where the rest of the appropriation for MMB is spent. You can see that we have to provide some debt service for the accounting system, the SWIFT accounting system that we replaced several years ago. Some of you will recall the old MAPS system that was replaced, and we now have the SWIFT system, but we do have a debt service we have to maintain on that purchase. In the other funds area, these are funds, the $16.8 million are funds that we bring in from statewide business systems and enterprise activities where we charge other agencies. We have systems billing support for other agencies. We provide HR system operations, and revenues also come in from training and different consulting units. And then finally, you'll notice at the bottom of the general fund, the $20.5 million number, those funds support the core activities of MMB, the accounting, the budgeting, the economic analysis, the debt management, the enterprise, human resources, labor relations, and management services. So this gives you a broad overview of how the appropriation for MMB is allocated. Now, if you go to the next page, what we tried to do was take that 5%, not the 95% of CGIP and PIP, but the 5% that's used from MMB activities and show you how those funds have been allocated throughout the division or throughout the agency. You'll see that these are fiscal year 13 actuals, so we wanted to show you how the money was actually appropriated through fiscal year 13. We obviously will be updating this depending upon what the legislature does. But before we just one more item before we get into the different change items, so you can see where we've asked for additional funds. We try to use different strategies to deliver mission and support services for Minnesota government. I think one of our core responsibilities is to make sure that we provide direction and unity for the agencies. And part of that is through the statewide accounting system and human resources, so that we provide the same kind of human resource and accounting system support throughout the system. We try to provide information access and forecast so that all state agencies can have the same information to base their activity on. We try to also provide oversight and controls and compliance outreach to make sure that we see overall integrity of the state operations. And finally, we try to support decision activities. We try to manage the cash management transactions, employee health insurance, management consulting for all agencies, and also we support strategic planning for the different agencies. With that small task in mind, let me walk through the change items that we've proposed. The first one, budget change items, unless there are any questions before we jump in there, Madam Chair.
I actually do have a question for you. Talking about the CGIP and the PEEP portion of things. Yesterday we had Mr. Anderson spoke to the group about MMB's management role of PEEP. How much would you say does MMB spend resources on that role, that responsibility? Do you know by chance off the top of your head, or do you have a phone friend with you that can maybe answer that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I may need to phone a friend on that one. You're talking about just the PEEP portion of that. You know, I don't have that in front of me. I don't know if anyone here has that, but we'll see if we can get that before the morning is out and
okay,
get that to you. But it is by far the largest majority is the CGIP or the state employee, but I don't have the exact number.
Right, because that's the 9/11 is just the CGIP, correct? Okay. All right. Members, do you have any questions for Commissioner France before he proceeds to the change items at all? Okay. It's yours.
Madam Chair, thank you. Well, I've thoroughly bored everyone already. That's a good news. I'm going to ask that Michelle start off with the first thing, Michelle Weber, our Director of Enterprise Resource Planning, to talk about the first item that we request a change on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to be giving you an overview of the enterprise systems request that's included in the governor's recommendation. This is line 51 on the one-page spreadsheet that Ms. Roberts put together for you, and it's also page 8 of change item overviews that are provided. The governor is recommending $2 million in fiscal year 16 and $4 million beginning in fiscal year 17 and beyond for the purposes of supporting the maintenance of our statewide systems. This includes the statewide accounting system, the human resource system, the employment application system, which is ResumeX, that is being replaced and will be available later this spring. A enterprise learning management system, which supports training offerings that agencies make, as well as our budget systems. The purpose of these funds will be to support software upgrades that are necessary to maintain current operations for the systems. Our support for these systems, we have a vendor-supported software that we utilize for the systems, and the maintenance and support for them are scheduled to expire in 2017. So we need to begin the process of upgrading those systems. We'll do that through a cycle by focusing first on our accounting and procurement system and our enterprise learning management system. We will also utilize dollars beginning in fiscal year 18 to replace necessary hardware for these systems to operate on. It's anticipated that the majority of this work would happen in partnership with external consultants so that existing staff can focus efforts on maintaining the current systems that are in place, which need to be available for the operations of state government.
Commissioner, we were just kind of comparing some numbers here from the handout you gave us from the change item documents that we received from the governor's office, and there's a slight difference. Can you kind of explain that, walk us through that part, please?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm noticing that difference as well. I'll have to check on that and get back to you why there's a little bit of discrepancy in some of those numbers. I do have the self-insured question for the PEEP. For fiscal year 2013, to compare apples to apples on the first page, the approximate total expenditures for that fund was about $46 million. So out of the entire fund operation there, for most of the, is obviously the CGIP, but there's about $46 million in operating funds for the PEEP.
Okay. That includes Inovo, I assume, doing the third-party management. But what are the actual, what does MMB charge back then to PEEP fund to pay for staffing to oversee it, or how does that work? And is that just rolled into the $46 million, or is that separate?
Madam Chair, there's about 1.5 full-time equivalents associated with the PEEP, and that is all the MMB compensation expense that's absorbed by the PEEP expenses. So it's only about 1.5 full-time equivalents.
Okay. And say that again, that's absorbed through the $46 million, or that's just absorbed by MMB? Did you?
That's absorbed through the $46
million. Okay. All right. Great. Okay, with members, I've got a couple things to sort out here. Are there any questions for MMB at all? Representative Nash.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question on line item 51. You are talking about some technological upgrades and some physical hardware. Would this not be better served being under minute? Is there no initiative to that?
Commissioner or Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, Representative, this change item was submitted in partnership with Minute, and we will enter into a service level agreement with Minute. Minute will oversee much of the technical, the majority of technical aspects of implementing this.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
Follow up. The items that you're going to be sending out to a third-party vendor, are those something that Minute doesn't have the capability to take on?
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative, Minute Services' existing staff will be focused on ensuring that our current operating systems are in place, so the accounting system in its current state would continue to operate, and existing Minute staff would also oversee and manage the contracts, work in partnership, provide direction to the vendors who would be coming in to implement, to work in partnership with us on implementing these upgrades. Oftentimes, we utilize what's called staff augmentation, and because of the specialized skill in these software products, they will actually contract with someone to come on and serve essentially as a staff person without actually adding a permanent FTE.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We've got Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Weber, what I'm trying to get some feel for how important this continuous upgrades are. What is the effect of if these sort of upgrades don't occur? What does that mean in real terms?
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, the upgrades are necessary for a multitude of purposes. One is in order to maintain our current levels of what we're paying for support. The vendors phase out the support for older systems, older versions of their software. So once the support is phased out, the state would actually incur an increased cost to maintain the vendor support for it. In addition, there's functionality that is made available in more recent versions of software. A primary example that we're struggling with right now is ensuring that the software is fully compliant with accessibility requirements, both for users as well as for the information that's produced from the systems. So the vendors will offer upgrades to their software products that will meet some of the business needs necessary.
Representative Johnson.
Nothing else.
Okay. Members, any other questions?
What area are we on?
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
Mr. Fran, Commissioner Franz. A question I have, you were talking FTEs, and just so we have a general idea when we're talking, what do you figure the cost of an FTE is per year in the budget cycle when you're figuring an FTE and, you know, on the, in the budget?
Commissioner Franz.
Madam Chair, Representative, with respect to M&B, are we talking just...
I think, Madam Chair, overall.
Representative Nelson.
Madam
Chair, do you have that data?
I don't have that data. That obviously is a complicated question in terms of how you would allocate that cost, but I'll have to get back to you on that.
It looks like you have a phone a friend that's coming to help you out here.
Oh, this is, yes.
If you could state your name for the record.
Certainly. Madam Chair, members, my name is Micah Intermill. I'm the acting statewide compensation manager at MMB. The average statewide per FTE cost is about $68,000.
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, is that for, that's just the salary, or is that the salary benefits the whole nine yards?
Total compensation, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Great. Okay. Any other questions we have? Anything? Oh, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at line 61 today. I'm trying to explain that, or figure out how to explain this to my constituents back home.
Representative Anderson, are you on the spreadsheet then?
Oh, no, I'm on the change.
On the change sheet. Item, line 61.
The change item, line 61. Okay. I understand Minnesota does collect an enormous amount of tax revenue for cigarettes. And yet, in this line, it says that the request for fiscal year 2016 is for $1.4 million to stop cigarette smugglers. I'm trying to understand the justification of that when we already have tax revenue from the tobacco tax to cover that.
Representative Anderson, do you want to say that for the Department of Revenue? Because they're going to be coming up next.
I can do that.
Okay, we'll do that. Anybody else have any questions at all? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you give me some idea what the hourly rate is for consultants for work on the upgrades?
Commissioner Franz or Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, I would have to follow up on that. I don't have that information with me, but I certainly can follow up and provide that to you.
Great. Thank you. I'd appreciate that if you could send that to the whole committee. That'd be great.
Of course.
Any other questions, members? Great. You're off the hook.
We just have a couple more that we want to hit before.
Sure. Yeah, that would be great. Thank you.
I know you want to move on to other agencies. I think just briefly we'd like
to
show...
No rush, Commissioner. We are... I just want to make sure we are mindful of members' time. So go ahead.
Well, thank you. So I'm looking at the change item. That's page 10. In your biennial budget page changes from MMB, this is the $1 million request to enhance enterprise level services. This would help us provide uniform guidance to state agencies. For example, the Veterans Preference Act requires that agencies maintain the preference for veterans in a uniform manner, and we need to provide some support and information to help agencies do that in a really fair and good way. We also want to conduct more use of data that we have to help improve our process. We want to help agencies expand their succession planning so we prepare for knowledge-based loss. As we know, more and more baby boomers like me retire, there's a need to make sure that we capture that knowledge and keep it inside the agency. We also want to develop some accessibility expertise and guidance to state agencies. We want to enhance affirmative action across the enterprise for diversity and inclusion. And we also want to expand communications to make sure that all agencies have the best information available to perform their various functions. Change item for the agency there. We also have an operating adjustment request for this is where our numbers differ a little bit. This one is listed as 579, and it really is. So it really should be the 866 that you show on line 50. The 866 is a combination of this 579 plus another 287, which would equal the 866. This is used to maintain our current level of service with respect to our compensation. about a 1.8% increase to the base funding for compensation due to labor settlement, labor contract settlements, insurance, and other employee expenses. And also, this would help us make sure that we don't have to, that we can avoid any staff reductions going forward. And then we have another another item, the MMB non-operating. This is on line 56 of your spreadsheet. This is the $7.5 million line item. This would be to expand the operating budget carry-forward authority. This would allow a uniform way for agencies to carry forward unexpended non-grant operating appropriations. We believe it would be helpful to provide for a consistent treatment of state agencies so they have the same flexibility that other agencies do outside of the executive branch. This would reduce the need to forecast cancellations of certain appropriations to the general fund. It would increase the agency's ability to flexibly manage their costs within their general operating expenses or projects, and it really provides an incentive to manage the appropriation more efficiently, and would remove the sort of use it or lose it mentality at the end of the year, that we want to make sure the agencies make smart purchases, not purchases designed to get to the end of the fiscal year. And then finally, we have an MMB non-operating tort claim appropriation. This is a $0 effect, and I'm not sure where this shows up on your spreadsheet. If it does, this would allow, there's about 600,000 appropriation would be made to MnDOT directly. All work that's being done related to these tort claims is done by MnDOT with the exception of the payment. And so by moving this appropriation to MnDOT, that would allow them to do the work and make the payments without requiring MMB to act as a middleman in that situation. And that, those are our change item requests, Madam Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Kranz. In regards to the expanded carry forward authority, what kind of parameters are put in as far as how far forward it can be put forward and so forth? It sounds like this is a kind of like a slush fund that they can kind of move on to the future. I don't necessarily have a problem with it, but I do think there needs to be some sort of parameters. Do you have any of that in mind?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, that's an excellent question, an excellent point. I mean, that's the last thing we want to have happen. Well, we want to make sure that agencies manage their money effectively and efficiently. And I think one of the things that we can talk about, we've discussed various ways to monitor that or ask for reports or whatever. So I think that's something that we're still working on. We'd be happy to work with you on developing some guidelines to make sure that it's consistent with the direction of the legislative appropriation in the first place.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to follow on to Representative Petersburg's question, Commissioner Friends, on the carry forward issue, can you give me a practical example?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I think, Representative, one of the issues that I would kind of give an example of is that, especially with the timing is so interesting when we're coming up to the end of a biennium like we are right now for the agencies, and the new budget has not been approved yet for going forward for any agency, obviously, it's difficult at this time in the year, the last 4, 5, or 6 months left, to know exactly what your operating budget is going to be for the next biennium and what your personnel cost or your employee cost is going to be. And so to the extent you add employees to your base right now, you're really adding to a potential problem for the next biennium depending upon what appropriation you get going forward. So there's a sometimes a tendency to want to purchase items that are not employee or compensation based, but rather particular needs you might need. Maybe there's an IT upgrade you need at this point. You know you're going to need it in the next year or so. So you might decide to purchase that item in April or May as opposed to September or October. But it doesn't add to your operating base going forward because it's not the continuing cost. So I think agencies try to manage their appropriations in a way at this time of the year, the biennium, without knowing what's going to happen for the next biennium. So I think it would remove some of that ambiguity in terms of being concerned about what you spend your money on.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Commissioner, don't they already have a budget that is working for them, and they plan what to do in that budget, so when they come up to the end of that cycle, that's where they're planning for the next budget cycle. So it seems a bit I'll defer to use other colorful language to subject the budget to a carry forward, just because you can't, in some senses, manage a budget that you've already put in place to know what you're going to do over that cycle. Why would you allow for someone to not be subjected to the budget they put in place and agreed to abide by just for the sake of, well, we don't know what's going to happen in the next budget cycle? I think a little op-ed here, that's the purview of the legislature and the governor deciding on what each agency is supposed to be responsible for. And if the agency, in a sense, says, well, we'll agree to that budget, but we've got some wiggle room in there, it seems like the bureaucracy is getting ahead of the citizens' decision in terms of how they want to fund their government.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think one of the things that happens, I mean, there would be no spending outside of the appropriation that the legislature has made. One of the things that happens, for example, with personnel is people come and go, and the attrition rate is difficult to manage, and sometimes you'll see a higher attrition rate at different times of the year, and you'll have funds available that you didn't otherwise anticipate having. Or likewise, you may have an IT expenditure that you didn't anticipate that's an absolute a requirement to run your systems, or you've been allocated and appropriated money. So the budget is, even though it's appropriated for the biennium, it's something you have to manage on a daily basis. It's a constantly changing number because nothing is ever as we see it's going to be during the 2 years. So there's always ambiguity and changes that occur that are entirely within the appropriation made by the legislature, but there's some variance toward the end of the biennium in terms of how those buckets are used up during the course of the 2 years. So it's not anything outside the scope of authority. It's simply spending how to spend within those different buckets of authority when there's some changes in those numbers toward the end of the biennium.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it just seems to me like from your answer that some agencies are planning for a year and 6 months as opposed to 2 years. And they're not sure what the last 6 months are really going to hold, and so they're kind of playing this cat and mouse game with their budget and also the budget in terms of what can we put into this budget that we can't, you know, don't have to worry about putting into the next budget. If they're planning for 24 months, they should be planning for 24 months, not for 18. And I'm sure every budget, just as every home household budget, has contingencies in terms of if an unforeseen circumstance prevails upon an agency, you better have planned for that. Or if it's an obsolescence of software or hardware, as we're talking about technology, that's something that can be planned for. I'm having a hard time understanding why you want extra when it doesn't sound like you've planned credibly for what has already been provided.
Okay, would you care to comment?
Madam Chair, yeah, Representative, I think I'll go back to my private sector experience and in running a small company. We had budgets that went out 3, 4, 5 years, and they never seemed to occur the way we planned them to occur because of changes in the economy, changes in cost, changes in personnel. So I think to assume that the budget is a static number and that no changes occur during the 2 years is just not the way the reality works. And I think that all agencies have to figure out how to manage those costs. The IT change you may have had to make may have cost 20 or 30% more than you anticipated a year before because of changes in the economy. So I think there is a lot of dynamic aspects to managing the budget on a 2-year cycle.
Okay, and Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Commissioner, to that very point, I've been in the private sector all my life, and when a budget goes bad, you don't go asking for more money. You wait until the next budget cycle, and then you plan accordingly for it. You don't go back and ask for more money. But if you do, there are such mechanisms as the deficiency bill that we are deliberating as well. And so to, in a sense, assume that you're going to have problems before they ever occur seems symptomatic that you're going to be not as stringent and not as respectful of your own budget because you've got some wiggle room in it and say, well, you know, we don't have to adhere so much to the budget that we put in because we've got this little piece of money over here that we can work with if we really need to. So I think it bodes the question of, are we being as stringent with our budgets as we should be? I would clearly admonish you to really rethink that because I don't think it's in the best interests of the state of Minnesota.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I've got two questions, and one goes down this vein a little bit, and I've gone through zero-based budget. I've gone from a base budget to a zero-based budget and found out that I had tons of things in that base budget that had been in there for decades that needed to come out, and I'd like to see us someday go to a zero-based budget because I think we could save a ton of money. But when we talk about, and I understand when we come to the end of the year and you got some unexpended funds, a lot of folks, me included back then, used to buy things that we probably didn't need at the time, but if I didn't spend it, I was going to lose it, so we spent it. Not good, the accounting practices, and in that realm, I kind of understand why it would be a benefit to carry those funds forward and use it in the next budget cycle. But my question comes to own, if we don't recapture that at that point, when in the future would we recapture that? Going off of Representative Petersburg's question there, when do we in the future recapture those funds that weren't expended at that time?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the key is that it is obviously a legislative appropriated amount that the agency has to deal with. And so I think that, as I was mentioning to Representative Petersburg, we need to make sure that we have guidelines and procedures and reporting so that if there is a carryover, it's managed within the parameters so that the next budget is approved by the legislature for that next year. So we'd want to make sure that it's followed directly. And we can work on how that guideline might be set up, but I think it's an important point to remember.
And Representative Howe.
Thank you. My next question goes under the Veterans Preference Act and trying to manage that. We already do that for a lot of the women and minority groups already, and how much of an increase do you see coming from now the added veterans piece of that that Veterans Preference? I guess I'm wondering how much are you allocating there for that? Because my concern is I'd like to know how you determine that there's going to be that much of an increase in the veterans' preference for businesses. I'd like to know, you know, how you figured that out and what that increase you anticipate there.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll have to get the exact numbers, but I believe it's one full-time equivalent. And the way we were able to figure that out, Representative, was by the request from the agencies. We're getting more and more requests from the different agencies that don't have that tech expertise in-house, and we want to make sure that from agency to agency, there's guidance through this one FTE that would make sure all the agencies provide the right and the appropriate amount of oversight for the veterans' preference to be properly administered. So it's one full-time employee.
And Representative Howe.
You're looking at, you don't have an anticipated number of applications from businesses? That's the number I was really looking for. Is you got one FTE for that increase. What increase in requests or veterans preference review do you anticipate with that?
You know, we're going to pause a moment here. I think Mr. Shepherd has some light to shed on the issue.
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, just to help clarify for the committee, the governor's budget has two different initiatives that relate to veterans preference. One that's in the Department of Administration budget has to do with the rulemaking for veterans preference for businesses. The one that Commissioner Franz is referring to doesn't relate to businesses. He's talking about in 2009, the legislature changed the law about dismissal of veterans. State employees who are veterans, and their initiative, I believe, refers to more funding for that process, not businesses.
Thank you for that,
Representative.
Thank you for that clarification. Well, to that point, how many veterans preference request and is this just for the dismissal, or is this for the hiring practice, or is this for both, for all of the veterans preference activities?
Ms. Weber, Commissioner?
Madam Chair, it's for I think it's for just the discharge portion of it, and I don't have the exact number of requests from the different agencies that have pointed out the need for this, but this is just for the dismissal process.
That number, thank you. That number would be interested to see how many veterans that were dismissing from state employee. That would be a very interesting number.
Madam Chair, I'll be sure to get that information to you.
Okay. And Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, first I'm going to wanted to make a comment, but it wasn't the question I had initially. But the comment about not being able to go back for additional funding. I worked for a large corporation a number of years ago, and we were upgrading the IT department, and the costs were much greater than what had been budgeted for. And I wasn't in that department. If you know my computer technology, I wouldn't have gotten very close to it. But the department I was in had to chip in to cover the cost, as did all of the other departments for a relatively large oil company. To cover the increased unanticipated costs for IT. So sometimes there are different ways you go back. Just as a comment to Representative Albright's comment. But my question is, when we talk about carry forward unfunded liabilities, for example, with retirements under most of our contracts, you can, when you retire, get a certain percentage of your sick leave benefit. And we did have the problem with some local units of government that hadn't covered those costs as they move into the future. And I just happened to think of that when we were talking about carry forwards and so on. How do you budget for those potential costs that I'll just for purpose of discussion call them unfunded liabilities? Or maybe you do have them funded.
Commissioner, or Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, that is a good example of something that it is very difficult for agencies to budget for that, because oftentimes individuals won't provide notification of their plans for retirement, and there can be significant costs associated with that. The carry forward authority that's being put forward is really meant to be a financial management strategy for agencies, essentially to help them plan for those unanticipated costs that might come forward in the future. Something that is also a similar thing is the unknown circumstances of the labor contracts and what the results of those might be, increases in technology costs, things of that nature. So the purpose of the proposal is to allow agencies the flexibility that they currently have within the biennium, because they are allowed to carry forward operating dollars from the first year to the second year. This allows them to have that flexibility across bienniums.
And Madam Chair, just a comment. I mentioned local units of government. That became an issue because they hadn't accounted for those potential costs in some instances. If I recall correctly, within the Minsky system, some of the campuses were also cited at one point for not anticipating those future costs. So I only point that out as an example, at least in my mind, why you might need some authority to carry forward to cover some unanticipated expenses.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Franz, I think that was kind of getting to my question, too. When I first saw this and understood kind of what it meant, I also understood, and it, correct me if I'm wrong here, that a biennium pretty much is a finite timeline, which it starts and the next one stops and starts. And for me, as somebody who has to put together budgets all the time, knowing that programs and projects that you put together oftentimes do not follow within those strict timelines, it would make sense to me that you would want to have the ability to finish a project without having to stop it and then get reappropriated in the next biennium. And that was kind of the direction I was going with in regards to the parameters set of how we deal with it, because I think that is a key piece, that we allow those projects that they may not been able quite get finished, but we knew we had appropriated them, rather than having the agency come back to the legislature and ask for reappropriation and then eliminate the dollars that weren't spent and then recapture it again in the following appropriation, would be one of those things that would be beneficial. I think there is some danger, just as Representative Albright and Howell recommend and suggest, that we don't use it as kind of a slush fund just to to use it willy-nilly, shall we say, but really for those particular projects. So again, as we go forward, if this is enacted, the parameters and how it is used and for what purpose, I think, can make it a tool without it being abused. And so I would highly recommend continue working with that.
And just to this, Commissioner, what would happen, though, in a situation where we are in a budget deficit? And is this going to be a situation where the agencies see the writing on the wall and then quick capture the unspent funds, and that reduces our capabilities to manage the budget from the legislative level?
Madam Chair, well, this would obviously only be at the end of each biennium, and so I think the key would be that this would happen as we're approaching a budget session like we are now. So clearly we would have the benefit of the November and the February forecast. We'd be in the middle of the session, the budget session, and we'd be setting budgets, knowing whether we had a deficit or not. So I think in the context of ending a biennium, it's always within the context of a budget cycle, with being very involved with the legislature in deciding what we're going to do going forward, approving a budget based upon a potential deficit. So in those situations, I think we'd want to be really careful in terms of how much we would allow for this. But, you know, obviously this could be managed in a number of different ways. It could be managed differently in a deficit situation, as you suggest.
Yeah, I guess my concern is if are we binding future legislatures to a policy that they had no say on? So I think there's potential for that, or concern for that. But we have Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Commissioner. I am wondering if you know if there has ever been, you know, at any point in the past, or even if there is right now, any incentive offered to state agencies to save those resources. I'm also thinking, as a follow-up, you know, after the November forecast, if there shouldn't be, it's maybe more of a comment, but increased visibility to the public of the resources that are available, and between then and the end of the biennium, as to, you know, how those resources are expended or what the plan is, or the revised budget. So a question and a thought.
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, Representative, there was an initiative passed in legislation a few years back referred to as SAVI. I believe it's State Agency Value Incentive Program. It was a program that would allow agencies to apply to Minnesota Management and Budget for unanticipated savings they may have incurred, to carry forward half of those dollars into the future, into the next year, for particular initiatives. We did only have one agency apply for that in the past.
Representative Pugh? Mm-hmm. And what kind of savings were they able to achieve, do you know?
Thank you. It was $50,000, and it was the Department of Administration, Madam Chair.
Okay. And what kind of level of advertising do we do to encourage that at all? Or?
Madam Chair, we sent out notification to all of the state agencies that were eligible to apply that the program existed, along with application forms.
And do you do that on a yearly basis then, or? Hmm?
Madam Chair, it's on a biennial basis because it was only for carry forward at the end of the biennium. And the first year was the end of the last biennium. So this, we're coming up on the end of the biennium this time around.
Any further questions, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering how you came up with the number of $7.5 million for this particular piece.
Commissioner, or Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, Representative, in the forecast, each at the end of each biennial cycle, we anticipate a number that will be canceled, both of operating dollars as well as grant or direct aid to individuals. This is the anticipated amount of operating funds that, based on past trend, that we've seen cancel.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I would just so strongly encourage the the agency to give consideration to implementing protocol whereby the six-month period between the forecast and the end of the biennium is heightening visibility for the public and the taxpayer as to what resources agencies have available and that revised budget as to how those resources are going to be expended, so that use it or lose it mentality doesn't even enter into the process. So, thank you.
Okay, we've got Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as we're going in this discussion, it hit me that as I was watching the news last night, they were interviewing a gentleman that ran a fleet of seven trucks, a service, I think it was a heating and air conditioning company, and they were interviewing about the gas prices, that 2 years ago gas was up to $4 a gallon, now it's down around $2 a gallon, and he was, in his budget, he was anticipating that, that he was saving $50 per truck per week in his costs. And I think it was, as we look at the amount of snow we've had this year, 2 years ago we anticipated probably a normal amount of snow that MnDOT would be plowing off our roads, and we haven't had that much snow, so there's savings there. So when we talk about a budget and saying you've got to spend exactly this amount of money, it's kind of ridiculous to look at that going forward, because we can't anticipate what the weather's going to be, what the cost of gas is going to be. I know a few years back when gas was going up exponentially every seemed like every day, they were having to make cuts to deal with, we need to plow the snow when we have a large amount of snow. So I mean, to say this is a static thing, that okay, we set this budget, we're projecting 2 years out that this is how much we're going to spend, and we don't anticipate that three people are going to retire, and so we're going to not have those positions that we're funding. We don't anticipate that we're going to have a winter like we've had so far, knock on wood, that we don't have a lot of snow. These are things that we guess at in the budgeting process, and hopefully at the end of the biennium, they come out pretty close to what we guessed. I think that's what the commissioner here is saying, and we don't want to have the stories that we hear, the anecdotal stories that we hear all the time about government agencies, that they're coming to the end of their budget, they've got a big pile of money that they haven't spent because they've been judicious with what how they spent their money, and going out on a big spending spree at the end of the biennium, so that if they don't spend it, the next biennium they're not going to have that money, and they're going to be stuck with less amount of money that they may need. So I think what we're talking here with the carry forward is a good thing, and I think it helps them manage and helps to prevent those things from happening in our budget.
Okay. Members, we do have folks from the Department of Revenue here, too, and a couple other items to do on our schedule. I think what we'll do is Ms. Weber was here for MMB to talk about the legislative office building. I think we'll bump that to the end of the schedule to have it coordinate with admin.
Madam Chair, I don't believe that's me.
Oh, is it a different Weber? Okay. All right. Well, okay. All right. Well, we will we'll have that towards the end, but we do have a couple members have more questions. We've got Representative Rumbeck and then Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just trying to get a handle on all this. And first of all, I note that the agency collects fines and fees and penalties. Is that correct? What type of fines, fees, and penalties in your department? I understand revenue, but Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, we collect very few fines and penalties, but I'm not, I'll have to get specifically what we do, but there are not very many inside of MMB, I know.
Okay. Representative Rumbeck?
Madam Chair, it says on page one of your non-operating budget, there you collect $11.5 million in miscellaneous fines, fees, and penalties.
Commissioner? For members that are looking for it, it's in the at-a-glance box on page one of the non-operating MMB.
And Madam Chair, the discussion is on page two of the change item budgets. And the description we have here is that we charge various activities, including marriage. We collect, the state charges various fees for activities such as marriage licenses, engaging in adoptions. We assess fines and penalties when the citizens are out of compliance. So the receipts that we use here are dedicated to these activities across MMB, and so we're actually an intermediary collecting and receiving some of these fines, and I'll have to get you more information about exactly how we collect that, but I'd be glad to do that.
Okay, that would be great. And just another question, just a quick one too, Madam Chair. So these pages of non-operating, so you manage funds.
Right.
Could you just go to page 3 of that? I'm curious, when it talks about a state aid expenditure, and what is that, and is that $41 million, or just what is that, Commissioner?
Chair, Representative, I'm not sure what page you're on.
Page 3 of the non-operating budget detail?
Yes.
Is it the expenditures by program, Representative Runbeck?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Commissioner, do you have the spot, page 3?
Yes, I'm sorry. And your question, Representative, I'm sorry.
Well, Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Commissioner, could you just describe what that is and, you know, is it how much? I know it's not $41,000, but, I mean, what state aid is that?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, that's, yeah, $41 million, and I don't have the particular information in front of me on that and that particular item. I'll have to get that for you. I'm okay. Sorry.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate that.
That's right. Okay.
Ms. Roberts, do you have any feedback on that?
Madam Chair, members, I'll work with MMB to get some additional information. Some of the things that flow through here from a fund balance perspective might include pension aids and things like that, but we'll work together to get the exact details.
Thank you. Okay. All right. I think we are done. We'll probably have you guys come back at a later time, too, as we go over more details. But thank you so much. Appreciate your time, Ms. Weber and Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay. And we've got Department of Revenue next. Welcome to the committee, and members, I think you're going to start with this handout, correct?
Yes.
Okay. It's a little State of Minnesota handout for folks. Commissioner, if you can introduce yourself for the record. And
thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Cynthia Bowerly. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. Members of the committee, thank you for your time this morning. I will briefly introduce the department, and then I'm going to step aside and let other members of our team present in a little bit more detail some of the information that you have on the one pager in front of you. But I just wanted to start by sharing with you our view for how we serve our customers across the state. Our customers are also your constituents. They are the families of Minnesota, businesses, students, veterans, all of whom deserve a fair and efficient tax system to interact with as they fill out their individual forms and those resources that come into the state to fund important initiatives. So they deserve a department that vigorously protects their personal information, provides information, outreach, and education so that they can have the information they need to file their taxes, and enforcement where necessary to ensure fairness across the system. And the department needs two resources to be able to do this: highly trained, dedicated, and talented staff, and technology systems to provide the most efficient and fair system. So I'm going to introduce our Deputy Commissioner Ryan Church, Assistant Commissioner Terry Steenblock, and Assistant Commissioner Pete Squira to give you details about our proposal and answer questions, and I, of course, will stay to make sure that I'm available as well to answer any of your questions.
Great.
Thank you for your time.
You bet. Deputy?
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Madam Chair, members. Again, my name is Ryan Church. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at Revenue, and I have joining with me this morning Assistant Commissioner Terry Steenblock, who's the Assistant Commissioner for Individual Taxes, and also Pete Squira, who's the Assistant Commissioner for Administration within the department. And again, just thank you for the opportunity to give you a brief overview of the agency, talk a little bit about what makes us tick and the strategies that we use before we get into the individual change items. I see that you are working with a lot of paper this morning, so we're trying to keep it simple. One page, no PowerPoints or anything else. So I think we can move through this fairly quickly so that you have plenty of time for questions and discussion. Before I get into the one pager, I'd like to just set a little context up front. And that's basically to say that In the last few years, the Department of Revenue has seen a significant increase in the demand for customer services. So we're talking about the number of calls, for example, that come into the call center, the number of requests for information or assistance that we get from taxpayers, the number of community outreach efforts that we do, whether that's working with military families to help them understand their credits, or working with new immigrants or others new to Minnesota who might be going through this for the first time. Those are the kinds of things that we're seeing a lot more of demand for and we're engaged in to a much greater degree. Even the number of tax types that are being filed electronically has increased significantly over the last few years. Excuse me. Meeting these demands is important because this is what helps taxpayers voluntarily pay their taxes. And by the way, the vast, vast majority do. So it's important that we respond to this demand, and that's part of what we'll be talking about today. It's also fair to say that the department has responded effectively to this new demand, so far at least, and primarily by focusing on our limited resources where the greatest priority is, having the flexibility to move those resources where we need to meet those demands and assist our customers. Also by using technology wisely. I don't think it's hard to imagine how incredibly dependent the agency is on strong technology systems, and we change those systems on an ongoing basis. Anything else that we can do to find efficiencies within our operations, sometimes even physical location of how workflow and paper that comes into the agency, those kinds of things are constantly assessed and adjusted. So, I mean, there's some great success stories here, and I think some great accomplishments, and we'll talk a little bit about that, but we really wouldn't be telling you the whole story if we didn't also acknowledge that with those demands and those increased demands and increases costs throughout a number of our operations, and we'll talk about those specific costs, that's resulted in a reduced ability to meet future need. So if we look down the road, again, if we look at the next biennium, it's clear to see that we need to make targeted investments in areas that are going to make the most difference for Minnesotans. And we're not talking about going back to historic levels of FTEs. We're down about 200 FTEs since 3 years ago. Those days are gone. We're not going back there. We've had to adjust to that. But the trick will be having the right amount of resources to focus in the right places, again, so that we can make a difference for Minnesotans. As we walk through the material, I think you'll get a better understanding of what we're saying here and get a better sense of the situation. But we thought it was important to say right up front the basic reason for our request. These are the key drivers that we're managing. We're eager to start the work of the next biennium, and we're really looking forward to working with this committee to make sure that we get that right and we serve Minnesotans well. Back to the one-pager. If you'll just look at the words at the very top of that page, I just want to touch on a couple things very briefly. The words you see there are integrity, respect, excellence, and accountability. These are basically the values that the agency holds important. So integrity is really about working honestly and ethically. Respect is recognizing and embracing diversity and making sure that we respect one another within our work as well as the people with whom we work outside of the agency. Excellence is really about expecting and rewarding innovation and collaboration. And accountability is really just honoring our commitments and following through on those things. So that's a little bit about how we try to operate and the things that we hold as important within our operations. The mission statement is the belt around the state, basically working together to fund Minnesota's future. Of course, there's many, many people involved in that process. So we're talking about individual taxpayers, businesses, tax professionals, local government, many other agencies. But the important part that revenue plays in that whole activity is making sure that we have the people, the know-how, the systems to make that whole revenue picture work. Lastly, the vision statement is just the green banner across the middle of the page. And so the vision that guides us, this work is that everyone reports, pays, and receives the right amount, no more, no less. And I hope you sense the balance we're trying to strike there. This is not just about making sure that people pay in the right amount, but that we also want to make sure that people are receiving the credits and the refunds to which they're entitled. So I want to pivot now to Terry Steenblok. We'll talk a little bit more about, again, the strategies and how we do this, and just briefly touch on our key results.
Okay. Ms. Steenblok.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Terry Steenblock, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes. Before I talk about the results, I do want to briefly talk about our strategies. Last summer, we revised our strategies to reflect a balanced approach. We have five key strategies within the agency, and I'm just going to touch on a couple of them. One of our strategies is focused on information and outreach. And as you may know, 96% of the taxpayers voluntarily file and pay their taxes. And a key way for us to build upon that success is to make sure that we're providing customers with information and resources they need to be able to file and pay their returns. We do this in many ways, but some of the more prevalent ways that we do this is providing forms and instructions and outreach activities across the community. And I'll talk a little bit more about those outreach activities in just a minute. Leveraging technology and creating efficiencies is critical to our success within the agency. On a daily basis, we use technology to support our mission and vision. We process more than 5 million returns a year, and technology plays a large role in making that happen. Even more importantly, our customers are demanding more technology. They want the ability to be able to do business when it's convenient to them and in a manner that works for them. And so when we're investing in technology, we're not only investing in it for ways to help administer the tax system, but we're also investing in technology in ways to help our customers be able to file and pay. And so some of those examples you may have seen, our business taxpayers can now electronically file. They can see copies of their returns. They can see copies of the payments that they make with us, and they can electronically communicate 24/7. We've also started developing free file solutions for individual taxpayers, such as our free homestead credit refund solution for homeowners. But these are just the tip of the iceberg. Again, our customers are demanding more technology, and the appetite is definitely there. We would be remiss if we didn't talk about our balanced approach. The balanced approach is not only working through outreach and education, but it's also identifying tax enforcement and identifying taxpayers who don't accurately file or fail to file at all, and making sure that we review those returns and work through audit and collection activities, making sure that we're working with customers to review and resolve tax appeals that may come forward, providing legal direction and assistance when necessary, and at times representing the state of Minnesota in court and administrative hearings. I do want to turn your attention to the one-page document at the bottom. You'll see our results. I want to talk briefly about the results that we've had within the agency. We are responsible for collecting $20.5 billion per year at the agency, and this represents over 90% of all state general fund collections going to support state programs such as education, human services, and public safety. We processed 5.2 million returns last year, and what you don't see there is the additional 1 million returns we processed as a result of federal conformity, or the 3% and 6% changes that we made to property tax returns as a result of legislation last year, or the 80,000 one-time supplemental agricultural checks that we issued. As you can see, we participated in over 1,000 outreach activities last year. Our outreach activities really focus on meeting with the public, attending public meetings to provide education, providing training, whether that's virtual training via technology or face-to-face training with small businesses and individuals. It's also participating in special activities such as military reintegration events. So we travel out of state when our members of the military are coming back to make sure that they're aware of the credits that are available to them and they know how to get those credits. Customer service comes in all forms, ways, and shapes for us. We talk about our walk-in, call-in, and click-in environment. Last year, we served 750,000 customers in this manner. The year before that, we served over 600,000 customers, and we are projected to serve reach 850,000 customers by the end of this year. So the demand is increasing greatly, and the types of customer service is increasing as well. It's no longer just where's my refund, it's more technical tax-related questions and being able to answer those so taxpayers can file and pay. But we are more than an agency that collects revenue. We play a significant role in providing nonpartisan revenue analysis to the executive and legislative branches of government. Our research team produced more than 950 revenue analyses on proposed legislation and tax policies, and this is up from 650 revenue analyses. And finally, not only did we assist 3,420 local units of government, but we also collect debt for all state agencies and areas of government, such as municipal ambulance services, and we generate about $8 million in additional revenue for the general fund. With that, I'm going to turn it over to the Assistant Commissioner for Administration, Pete Squira, and he will talk about our change items.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Pete Squira. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Administration at the Department of Revenue. As Terry and Ryan have both touched on, our recent successes and our ability to effectively meet our customer demand. In addition to an increased demand, we've experienced increased costs of service. Cost increases of contracted services, of technology, of our people, and of our space has we have been able to successfully manage that in the past. So with that said, we're going to talk now about what we are proposing in the governor's budget. I'd like you to turn to the back of the one sheet if you haven't already done so. The first change area is entitled Respond to Customer Demands and Deliver Excellent Service. The proposal funds a balanced approach in improving Minnesota's tax system. The revenue's largest expense is in our people. Over 70% of our budget is in people costs. Revenue staff are educated, they're trained, they're highly skilled, and they're stewards of Minnesota's resources, as are mentioned in our values. We are asking your support in retaining our human capital and who is responsible for delivering excellent customer service and fairly administering our tax system. This request represents 1.8% of our compensation costs in the general fund of our employees. That's number 59, line 59 on Ms. Roberts' spreadsheet. Another piece of it is our increasing demands for services, coupled with increasing costs, have given us the opportunity in the past few years to change our operations. We have made efficiencies and prioritized our work. We've implemented e-services, as Terry has mentioned, on a number of tax types. This not only allows customers to file and pay electronically, but check their payments online and retain correspondence electronically at their leisure. But it also allows revenue to become more effective in our operations in its return processing, fraud detection, and data capture. We've also used plain language to rewrite letters and forms. What this allows is customers better understand the content of the letter and any needed action on their part. This reduces the need for follow-up contact of these customers and allows our contact center staff to focus on more technical questions from those attempting to file and pay voluntarily. Through the governor's uncession, we've reduced the number of forms and payment vouchers. The reduction of forms, the number of forms, allows customers to file and pay without confusion. It eliminates the need for resubmission of these forms due to using their incorrect form. It also reduces the number of forms and vouchers that our staff needs to update and maintain. We've also analyzed resources that we purchase excuse me, and scaled back on the need based on our operation. Examples include reviewing our number of emails that we utilize, looking at our telephony replacement cycles, and software license purchases that we use in our department. Even though we've made these efficiencies and prioritized work, we see an increased demand and increased costs that have resulted in reduced capacity. We have absorbed to the point where there is reduced audit activity. There's diminished customer service support through our contact center. There's a delay in processing time of customers' income, amended income tax returns, and a limited ability to collect our debt, both state
and other agency debt. So this initiative, number 59 and number 60, both coupled together on Ms. Roberts' spreadsheet, will retain our current staffing levels with the 1.8% annual increase of general fund compensation costs with additional operational efficiencies. We will maintain and enhance current technology systems, such as the integrated tax system and our Property Records Information System of Minnesota, otherwise known as PRISM. This is the data collection for our property tax records throughout the state in 87 counties. These are business-critical systems that directly impact customer service and our security. We'll also continue to purchase essential services, such as contracts for legal counsel, subject matter experts for audit cases, and lease costs in the Stassen building. We will meet increasing customer service demands, such as phone calls and other taxpayer assistance, community outreach activities, and our tax research activities or services. Again, this level of funding does not restore our operations to historical levels, but rather ensures that we do not lose ground on our most critical functions. Moving on to the middle of the page, the back page, is our Stop Tobacco Smuggling Initiative. Smuggling of cigarettes and other tobacco products into the state has substantially increased recently. In 2004, 40% of our retail inspections resulted in either seizure or assessment related to the discovery of untaxed tobacco products. In these inspections, revenue uncovered increasing evidence of tax evasion. This proposal enhances our enforcement personnel, increases penalties on those who do not pay tax, creates a statewide license for retailers to ensure that honest businesses are not at a competitive disadvantage, and also raises revenue from licenses, fines, and tax collection, both enforcement and voluntary. The next one is our tax policy fiscal provisions.
You know, I think I'm going to pause you right there. We have several members that have a lot of questions, and I think it would be helpful for us to kind of get through those first. So with that, Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. I want to harken back to Representative Anderson's question regarding the whole nature of this $2.457 million request to stop tobacco smuggling. Can you help us understand a couple of things? The number of FTEs you're proposing, equipment, enforcement, and just what all is bundled into the $2.457 million, and what is it you expect to actually collect out of that exercise?
Mr. Square, our deputy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Nash. What this proposal does is creates an enforcement unit who's working with local units of government, public safety, educating them on the issues of tobacco smuggling. There'll be 11 FTEs, as noticed in the change item. Part of that is legal services when trying these cases and looking at the cases of smuggling. The revenue side is $2 million per year, just over $2 million a year, and that's fines and assessments. But we also are projecting compliance, voluntary compliance for those who see the police on the highway, so to speak, and drive 55, that there will be some voluntary compliance due to additional enforcement.
Representative Nash.
Yes, follow up. So 11 new FTEs, and you called it a new unit. Is this going to be an autonomous group? Is there going to be now the tobacco enforcement policing unit, or what's the proposal here? And then would also defer to Representative Anderson for some other follow-up, since I know that he had a couple of questions along this line.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Nash. So we have a special tax unit right now which administers the tobacco tax, petroleum tax and a number of other different tax types. And we also have a criminal investigation division. This set of individuals would work closely in those spaces with those other individuals as well. So they would focus primarily on tobacco enforcement. And one of the things that we have started to hear from retailers, and we have met with petroleum retailers and the grocers and others interested in the space, is about the smuggling that is undercutting the legitimate market for these products, and that they sell and they pay and comply with the tax laws. And so what we want to do is make sure that everyone is on that level playing field. And so what we are starting to see is that there's more and more smuggling. There's always been smuggling of tobacco products. You can buy them on the street, or you would find them in retail stores, but we are seeing a larger amount of that in the stores. And what we really want to do is make sure that everyone is playing by the same set of rules. And so some of the revenue increase that you see is our estimate, and it is this is a difficult thing to estimate. We have highly qualified folks who do a revenue estimate work with all of you as well, and they have, this is their estimate, a conservative estimate of what we think we will be able to shift to that legitimate market instead of purchasing contraband in stores.
Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, so roughly $2.457 million to collect what you estimated to be $2 million, is that correct?
Commissioner?
Isn't that what I just heard?
Yeah.
Deputy Commissioner?
Yeah.
What's our next?
Madam Chair, members, the numbers that you're looking at are a biennial number. So if you look at that on an annual basis, the actual expenditure is in the neighborhood of a little over $1 million. It's the half of the 2.457, and revenue is about $2 million per year. I think it's actually having a much.
Madam Chair, I'm thinking we probably have enough time. We can come back to this at a later date, but maybe Representative Anderson had some questions as well.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to just start at the top of this. How much money does the state actually take in for tobacco taxes?
Deputy or Commissioner or Mr. Square?
Madam Chair, I apologize. I don't have that number with me. I don't know if staff do, but we certainly can provide that to you.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
A couple follow-ups on this. I'm just assuming that that's got to be a mass amount of money, because we raised the tobacco tax again. And I just don't understand why we would need to allocate a dime more of additional revenue to enforce any of this with all of that money that is currently there. Can you explain that?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, the amount of revenue that is raised from tobacco goes directly into the general fund. So the department does not take any administrative costs off the top of that. So we are asking to increase our agency appropriation, which comes out of the general fund. We do have a couple of other tax types where we do have some dedicated resources. This is not one of them.
Representative Anderson. I remember discussing this issue in the tax committee when this kind of came about, and we had a fellow that had been the main enforcer for the state of California, and he talked about the challenges and the difficulties of basically tracking down smugglers and addressing that side of things. But when we asked about, you know, the fiscal implications for the state, if I remember correctly, we were told that it's, you know, insignificant and whatnot. So I've asked Ms. Roberts if she can track down the fiscal note, if you can help her in tracking that down from the last go-around of several different proposals on this. Because if I remember correctly, we said that we wouldn't be incurring any more costs to the state to monitor smuggling. So I'd like to know if our fiscal notes are matching up with what we're hearing here today, you know, because that, you know, obviously impacts. And we rely on the fiscal notes in order to do budgeting, and we want to make sure that they're reliable and that we can count on that data for planning for the future, because as we've heard here a lot today, it's very important that we can have good numbers to plan for the future. So I think that would be helpful for us in moving forward, at least for this segment of it. But we have a couple other members that have some questions. We have Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wondered if you could provide us some information, some kind of continuing the conversation on fraud. What efforts do you have internally to prevent identity theft, to track it? I mean, how aggressively are you going after some of these? And, you know, what is the incident? And what kind of background checks do you do of people that are, you know, looking at our Social Security numbers?
Who's going to?
Madam Chair, Representative. There's several things that are in place. We have one of the best fraud groups in the nation. We partner with other states. We also partner with the IRS when we talk about fraud. Any employee, whether they're a regular full-time employee at the Department of Revenue or a contractor, has to go through background checks before they're allowed to be hired by the agency. They also have to participate in disclosure training as well to make sure that they understand the sensitivity of the data that they're using and how that data should appropriately be used. We also limit access to data based on the business need. So our system allows us to align security with individual roles. As far as taxpayers go, we do have some fraud criteria that's in place. We don't publicly share that because we don't want people to work around those fraud pieces, but we do have numerous things in place to identify and catch fraud.
Representative Rumbai.
I appreciate that. Do you have any dollar figure, Madam Chair, dollar figure on what you expend to protect us?
Ms. Steenblatt.
Madam Chair, members, I don't have that dollar figure with me. We'd have to get that dollar amount. We again, that's another place where we've invested in technology to help us. So it's not necessarily about individual people helping us detect fraud. It's a balance of both people and technology. So we would have to get you a number.
Okay, great. Thanks. I'd appreciate it.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I got a question of two areas, but I'll start with being that we were most recently talking about the smuggling of tobacco products. And I picked up on the fact that you said, or one of you did, that this would be a separate unit. And I was thinking of the overhead part of it, because I think in years past you also had a unit or some way that you were dealing with the smuggling of liquor. And is that a separate unit, the liquor enforcement part of it, relative to smuggling, bringing liquor in from other states?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that group that works on liquor is within our special tax unit. And with respect to this new unit, we would house them in the same place at the building at Stassen. We don't anticipate additional overhead costs with respect to this unit. They would exist on our current systems. We would not need any additional or separate technology for them in terms of how they go about their work.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was thinking more from the standpoint of separate unit. That implied to me that there would be a supervisor for that purpose, and on the face of it, it appeared that there might be some administrative duplication there. And maybe we can get a flow chart or get something that would give us a little better snapshot of that. Another question I had with the tobacco products, I'm a non-smoker, so I don't have to worry about bringing any in. But what constitutes smuggling? There must be some sort of a threshold. Somebody stops off on a trip from Illinois somewhere in Wisconsin and buys a carton of cigarettes. I suspect that's not a smuggler. But if they come back with a truck full, that's obviously a smuggler. But there must be a threshold there that you use to define smuggling.
Madam Chair, and I'm going to turn it over to Commissioner Steenblatt to give you a specific, but I will let you know that in December, State Patrol stopped a budget rental car, a rental van, a big box van coming in from Illinois. And within it, they found allegedly, they found four pallets of tobacco, allegedly untaxed tobacco. So it is coming in by the truckload, and that is what our retailers are seeing as really undercutting their market. But yes, there are, as an individual consumer, you can bring in tobacco that you purchase out of state for your own personal use.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, you're just confirming what I thought. You used as an example a truckload, but my real question was there must be some sort of a threshold. If it's not a truckload, is it a trunk full? I mean, at what point does somebody who crosses the border, if they're stopped, considered a smuggler, was my question. If you don't have that at the tip of your tongue, that's fine.
I hope this isn't a business plan, Representative.
I didn't hear. I do have my hearing aids in.
I'm just giving you a hard time. I think Assistant Commissioner Steenblok is going to help us out on that. Did you have further comments, Representative?
Well, I was done on the tobacco one unless there was an answer. I was going to go to customer service next.
I think she has an answer potentially for you.
Madam Chair, Representative, an individual who's bringing product over, there's a dollar threshold that's established, and individuals would be required to pay or file a use tax return and pay use tax based on that threshold. It's a relatively low dollar amount threshold, and off the top of my head, I cannot remember the dollar amount for sure. I think it is less than $1,000 that an individual would be required to file a use return and then pay any use tax on it. So that accompanies some of those individuals that are bringing things across the border.
Representative Carlson.
Well, thank you. And Madam Chair, my question goes to customer service because in the introductory comments, one of you mentioned that one of the demands on the department were immigrants learning to fill out tax forms, I assume. I'm a retired teacher, and I taught at a school where 40-45% of our students were new Americans, recently arrived immigrants. And on the counter, we would have all kinds of announcements lined up in different languages. So my question is, how do you respond to the variety of constituents that we would have in the state of Minnesota with such a variety of different languages? Do you have translators? Do you have the capability to put the tax forms in? I assume it's mainly English and Spanish, at least when I call. You know, the other option is Spanish, but you do have Hmong, you have Somali, Ukrainians. When I was teaching Northeast Minneapolis, that were coming in English language learners. I could go down the list, but it's 60-some at that particular high school, and I wouldn't expect you could probably have the capability for 60-some, but do you have the capability at least for some of the major English language learners? I'll use an education term, ELL, English language learner, and helping them with tax forms so that they can read them. I was glad that the forms are in plain English, but there are other people that are non-English speakers.
Commissioner or Deputy Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have a lot of things in place in this area. If a customer is calling into the agency, we use Language Line so that we can interpret in any language that's possible. We do have a dedicated outreach group that is dedicated in some specific languages that go out and educate portions of the population on their taxing requirements and doing a lot of relationship building, because tax administration in other countries means something different than it does here. So there's a lot of outreach, education, and relationship building that occurs there. We also have VITA sites, which are free tax preparation sites, and there are sites that are dedicated to different languages throughout the entire state of Minnesota. We are working on interpreting some of our material into a variety of different languages. We do have Spanish and English that's available right now, and we're expanding the written content as well. So this is an area where we do a lot. We participate in radio shows with certain cultures, and we work with the Department of Education to make sure that we're producing material that goes home to students that makes them aware of the credits and the information that's available, and that comes in languages that are prevalent in those particular districts.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, great. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Carlson pretty much went down the line that I was curious in, just
just emphasize the importance. The district I represent is primarily communities of color now, and that outreach occurs. Do you have specific measures and outcomes to demonstrate that it's being successful?
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do have specific measurements available. We do surveys, and we get feedback through those surveys as to how effective it is, what we can do differently. We also do some usability with them as well. As we're creating material, we go out to the specific communities and we ask them, you know, does this meet your needs? And we adjust the material based on that usability testing and the feedback that they're providing. And again, it's adjusted quite a bit as far as where we're going out, and we meet with the different boards, for example, and we talk about, you know, where is the most need, how can we deliver that information. You know, we work with the U of M, for example, as well, on different outreach approaches and for new immigrants that are coming into the country.
Representative
John. And thank you, Madam Chair. And in addition to using the telephone line that has the different language availability, what are you doing to diversify your workforce so that your employees are also people of color in outreach?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, having a workforce that reflects our customer base is very important to us. In particularly in those roles in outreach, language skills are something that we absolutely look for. As we've shared with you this morning, we are down FTEs significantly, and the current resources that we have means that we have not been doing a lot of external hiring at this point. So we have been promoting from within for open positions and allocating resources across the agency. All that said, it is a priority for us, and particularly in those jobs that interface with communities from different countries or with different language sets across Minnesota.
Representative Johnson. Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the commissioner or for the assistant commissioner, this is what you deal with every day. This is your tax code. This is what we put into law last biennium. How many of you read it? Commissioner?
Commissioner?
I've read significant portions of it. I haven't read it front to back in that format.
Representative Albright?
Thank you. So, to my point, we change the tax laws, or the tax laws inevitably change on a annual basis in some cases. It seems symptomatic to me, and this is a little bit of an op-ed here, that you're asking for more money, increase in your budget overall, as a symptom for an ever-increasing and ever more complicated tax system. What's the proportion of technology to manpower that you're asking for in this request?
Commissioner.
Mm-hmm. So the request as you know, from the initial, you have two change items that are grouped under that first set heading, and it is for the first year 29 and 16 respectively for those two breakouts of those, and the remainder is in technology.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if that's the case, then we are relying more and more on technology. And we live in a day where more and more people are filing their taxes online. The people that you're hiring, what educational background are they being pulled from? I recognize that some in leadership in your department are not CPAs, but are trained in law. I'm just curious how many CPAs you're intending to hire to deal with the beast that is our tax code.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, the job requirements do depend upon the type of position. So for a technology job, for example, that would focus on those specialized skills and not on CPAs. And as you note, a good share of our resources and our need is in technology, but of course we do need technical, whether it's minute resources or business side resources to operate those systems. We hire CPAs, lawyers, other tax experts across the agency, and of course, you know, we represent, we are, you see four of us here today, there are 1,500, approximately 1,400 people at the department across, in offices across the state who are serving customers to assist that. And we look very carefully at the position requirements and the educational requirements needed for that. And I will share with you that the private sector, we do have well-trained people, highly skilled people, and the private sector is often looking to hire our people because they are well-trained and well-versed in the tax code.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, as a maybe an aside, of the four of you, how many of each of you prepare your own personal taxes?
Mm-hmm. Well, Representative Albright, I think we're getting into some personal information there. I did want to ask a question, though, and this is probably something that we'll have a greater conversation on the FTEs. And, you know, I'm looking at kind of the trend that we've seen here. I think the low water mark for you guys was 1,218 FTEs. And right now, currently for this quarter, you're at 1,411. So you're 200 above your low water mark, and it tends to be that the trend is around, it looks like the trend is around 13, 14, somewhere in there. So that's kind of interesting. I know the conversation that you said you're down 200, but it looks like to me that you're up 200 from the low water mark. But we'll talk a little bit more about that later on when we get to the FTE portion, which will have to be another day. I do have Representative Pugh, and then I have one last question. And my apologies to the folks that we didn't get to today. I know that you take time out of your schedule. This took longer than I anticipated it would. And I appreciate you coming. I will bring you treats tomorrow since we have wasted your time today in making you wait through this committee, and I apologize for that. So Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I had two questions. I'll save my question relative to FTEs for another time. My question today is for Assistant Commissioner Steenblok, and it is with regard to the how I might work with your department to determine how many of my taxpaying, primary taxpaying constituents of 2013 are no longer primary taxpaying constituents in 2015 based on their having relocated out of our state. I'm just wondering if that is, they're still filing here based on their property that is now a summer home, but I'm just wondering how I could work with your department to get my arms around what, you know, how this relates to my House District.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, just as a starting point, we're not able to talk with you about individual taxpayers. We protect their information very vigilantly, as I think you would want us to. And to your point of the numbers of people who may be leaving the state, I know that is a great point of discussion. The academic research doesn't suggest that people make those decisions for tax reasons. They move because of jobs or other reasons. If there are particular, again, we can't talk with you about individuals, but if there is some aggregate data that you would like to, we could certainly work with you on whether that subset of data would be something we could share with you in a way that's anonymized for those purposes. So we'd be happy to talk with you about your
request. If I could just add, Madam Chair, there was recently a report by the state demographer that talks about migration among states, particularly about Minnesota and the neighboring states, which might be a great starting point, too, to get a general sense of what are the factors that influence people moving in and out of the state of Minnesota.
Yeah, and you can find that. I looked it up. It's on the web, and it's very helpful. We're losing a lot of our youth. We're actually now a state that's a big loser when it comes to population versus a gainer in population. So
thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just comment that anecdotally, I have heard feedback from countless constituents that's inconsistent with that, so I am anxious to drill down a little bit deeper. Thank you.
And the committee would appreciate kind of the aggregate data and how what you're seeing trend-wise as far as the population of the state, too. That would be helpful. So my last question for you is we made some changes into tax law. You guys had a division that helped out in providing the rebates for capital equipment, and now we no longer do that. We provide an upfront exemption. How many people were part of your division for providing those rebates? How many FTEs did you have in that segment?
It's small, but I don't have a number.
Madam Chair, if you'd allow us to get back to you with a precise number, that work generally is done in our corporate division, and so if I could go back to them and I'm not certain whether we had anyone dedicated full time to that work as opposed to allocated across other functionalities. So if I could get back to you on what other functionalities are we replaced that work with, or what that information looks like.
So, Commissioner, if you didn't have a so-called FTE, then obviously any of the costs related to processing those rebates, we'd appreciate the data on that.
Sure.
So, okay, with that, again, apologies to the folks that we weren't able to get to. You will be on deck for tomorrow. If you have a scheduling conflict, please let us know as soon as possible so we can make arrangements for an alternative time. And then for revenue and MMB, thank you for coming in today. I'm guessing that we'll probably have you come back at some point, too, because there's still some kind of outstanding questions, and we didn't get through all the change items. So with that, members, the meeting is adjourned.